I'm very happy now to welcome Manvendra Dubé. He is a climate scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So a few months ago, there was a lot in the news about this methane hotspot, and I think everybody saw maps of the Four Corners area with this bright orange dot in the middle that represented a huge outpouring of methane, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. And this has climate implications, which we'll talk about, but let's first talk about that hotspot. First of all, when was it first measured? I mean, is this a new discovery?
Okay, let me give you a little background and a history of it. So Los Alamos, I work at Los Alamos National Lab, and the LDRD program, internally funded by the director, funded a project for us to do some ground-based large-scale mapping of methane in Four Corners. We started this work in 2010 to 13 time frame, and so we were measuring, we were measuring CO2 from power plants to verify climate treaties. But while we were doing the work, we saw this pretty big methane signal because our instrument was measuring methane as well. So we thought pretty hard. We were a little surprised because there, nobody else had reported it. We actually then hooked up with NASA, who was analyzing satellite data, and those data go back to 2003. So when we both connected, satellites are very broad brush tools, sort of semi-quantitative. So they had a hotspot, but they weren't sure if it was real. So they coupled, and they were seeing it from 2003 to 2009. So very broad brush average, monthly average, tens of kilometer scale. We were sitting with much more precision. We were seeing it in time, early morning rise. So when we put the two together, we basically thought we had a very compelling case. We believed the data, both from the ground-based validation and the satellite. We published it in Geophysical Research Letters, which is a journal for the American Geophysical Union. It's a high-profile journal that publishes discoveries that are surprising and profound. So what we know is that the methane hotspot was seen by us from 2003 onwards to 2009, and then from the ground by 11 and 12. Now, it probably was there before 2003 as well, but nobody was measuring it.
Very interesting. Now, what kinds of tools are you using to make those measurements? I mean, you're talking about ground tools and satellite tools.
In this case, actually, the tools are pretty similar. What we do is we look, both the satellite and the ground base, to look at sunlight. We actually look at the sun directly, and then split the spectra into its components, and each gas, like methane, absorbs at a specific wavelength in the near-infrared, sort of not visible. The satellite does the same. It looks not directly at the sun, but the Earth is like a mirror. It reflects the sunlight, and it looks at the backscattered sunlight and looks at the same spectral features. But the ground base is a lot more precise. Two differences. The ground base is a lot more precise. It actually uses a standard, calibration standard for the satellites. The other thing is the satellite only goes over a place once a day if you're lucky. We were looking at it sunrise to sunset every minute. So they were very complementary in time and space and also calibration. So they're doing this. The principle fundamentally is the same. Spectroscopy, looking at each molecular's fingerprint, which is a vibrational spectra. Molecules vibrate and rotate, so we measured that.
And as you said, you were actually doing this to measure whether people were complying with climate treaties?
Interesting question. In Paris this year, they will be reviewing the international framework UNFCCC for climate agreements that were signed in Brazil and Kyoto, and they expire now. So the climate treaty has not been signed or agreed upon, but the whole premise of our project, funded by LGRD, was if there is a climate treaty, can we verify it? And that's a very challenging start. So our primary mission was to look at CO2, look at the power plants as a test bed, because we know the answer in the U.S. Can we verify it? And we actually showed in another complementary paper that was also profiled that we can do that. So space-based technique with appropriate effort can look at the CO2, which is a harder problem.
Interesting. So, yeah, I guess a climate treaty is only as good as compliance, and compliance requires verification.
And the laboratory, Los Alamos, has a very important role to play on a variety of treaties, and that's why we were interested in this work.
So let's talk about this leak. How much methane are we talking about? And of course, those quantities don't necessarily mean anything to the listener, but like, can you explain to us what this hot spot means?
Okay, so let me first give you a number. The number is about half of a megaton of methane per year. Okay, that half a megaton per year amounts to about 10% of all methane reported leaking from gas-related activities in the U.S. So
that's a lot coming out of a tiny little area.
Exactly. So that's the key. And the key finding, qualitative finding, was we actually, because we had such good data, we ran a model, a meteorological model, with the methane that is reported by EPA. And we actually figured out that the number that we measure is about a factor of 3 too high. So that was a quantitative finding, which means now EPA and the international UN will go back and relook at the inventories and go that. So it's a substantial amount that, if scaled appropriately everywhere, would matter a lot.
Now, where does this methane go? I mean, does it go way up high in the sky? Like, what happens to it when it comes out of the ground?
Okay. Methane is a long-lived greenhouse gas. So it basically has a lifetime of about 12 years in the atmosphere. So what it does is it actually basically, like CO2 or any other long-lived gas, it actually mixes and resides in the atmosphere. It becomes oxidized in the atmosphere in 12 years. So think of it, it goes everywhere. What happens is it mixes globally with the winds and the concentrations go up. It's about 1,800 parts per billion or 1.8 parts per million. So it's in very low concentrations, but it's gone up by 150% since the pre-industrial era. It's very complicated. So unlike CO2, where we know the sources are primarily combustion, methane is actually a very complex mixture of sources that include fossil sources, termites, landfills, vegetation. So it's a very hard problem for a scientist to tackle, and has played a pretty substantial role in the past warming of the same. It's the second most important greenhouse gas, but it's much more complicated.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, because it goes up in the air, it is a global. It has a global effect. Does it have any effect on the Four Corners area specifically?
Locally, no. I don't think it's a concern of explosion or toxicity. The concentrations, I said, are at several ppm. 1.8 is the baseline. So it's not an explosive or a health hazard. I think the primary two things. One is it's a it absorbs, it's 25 times more potent a greenhouse gas than CO2. And the other thing it can do, it's a precursor to make ozone. Ozone is air quality, and Four Corners region does have ozone. And if it's co-emitted with others, so we think, we also have measurements that were not published, that co-emitted with methane, because it's coming from the underground, are things like ethane. And they are very powerful air quality pollutants. So there is a local impact, there could be a local impact on air quality. And actually, I'll mention this month, based on this discovery, NASA and NOAA are doing a very extensive airborne and ground-based survey to really, we looked at a very broad brushes hotspot, which is 100 kilometer by 100 kilometer scale. And this campaign is now flying aircraft and trying to really map out where what is coming out. So it's a very complicated, but we're actually trying to understand it. So we'll learn a lot more of what's happening in our backyard in the coming months.
We're talking to Manvendra Dubey, climate scientist from Los Alamos National Laboratory. Now, where is this hotspot methane coming from?
Okay, so as I just said, the satellites and our data are very coarse. We actually, so our whole field of view was, when we say it's the hottest spot in the U.S., we're looking at the whole continental U.S. The hotspot, if you look at it, the resolution of the satellite is very coarse in space and time, so we're talking about, 50 by 30 kilometer scale resolution. It's very hard to tell you what exactly. In that 50 to 30 kilometer area, there's a lot going on. There's actually natural activity. There's coal outcrops. There's coal bed methane production, which has historically been the biggest area for there. So that's one of our primary target. It's actually a gas hub. So it's where a lot of the gas flows through and processed. There's a lot of oil and gas activity. The point I'd like to make is one of the key points in the paper was we've heard about hydraulic fracturing or fracking. From 2003 to 2009, there was not a lot of hydraulic fracturing going on. So I think by inference, and we have some ethane data, and this campaign is carrying out more ethane data, from all these inferences, we think it's probably a coal bed methane related. However, we have to know a lot more. One of the key findings of the paper was, you know, hydraulic fracturing has not happened much there. And nationally, it's created a lot of interest in methane leaks and all that. So one of the messages we want to give is we need to be understanding the past, you know, what happened with coal bed and other things as we jump on to what will happen for fracking. And let me actually add you one thing. Methane is a good story, too, because it has really, you can feel it in the pump. You know, you see hydraulic fracturing has reduced the prices. However, the caveat is that you can't leak methane because it's so much more potent a greenhouse gas. So if you leak the methane away, we really lose its benefit. Methane has got several advantages over coal. Methane actually is clean burning, and if you burn methane rather than coal, you actually emit half the amount of CO2 as coal do. So methane is climate friendlier than coal, and also not polluting. So people have been thinking of it as a bridge technology to carbon neutrality. And I think that's why, and the key to it is to minimize, understand these leaks and minimize them as we go to a carbon neutral economy or less carbon intensive economy.
I mean, you'd think that you would want to capture that methane instead of letting it leak into the air purely for economic reasons.
Absolutely. And Los Alamos, we also work with private sector, and the private sector is really committed and wants to. So you're absolutely right. I think if you're leaking away 10% of your commodity, that's a lot of money. And so private sector is really trying to, and there is, you know, there's technology to capture methane from landfills. It's happening. South Africa in coal mines are routinely captured, even here. So I think that you're absolutely right that methane should be captured. It's a commodity. And as I said, the private sector is committed to. And as we, it's a new thing, and there's a lot of controversy, but the DOE and other agencies are really trying to, you know, get to the bottom of it, develop protocols so it's not lost. And, you know, we harness both the climate benefits and the air quality benefits of natural gas, which is methane, over coal.
So methane is natural gas?
Natural gas is mostly methane with a few other things. But it's to zero order, it's methane, yeah. Natural gas has other things. It's not pure methane, but other hydrocarbons. They mix it with ethane sometimes just to enhance the energy value. But it's 90%+ methane.
So there was, in the period where these measurements have been made in the first decade of the 20th century, there was not a lot of oil and gas fracking in this area. But I was reading an EPA report, and it said that there were 2,550 coal bed methane wells operating in that area, and they were all using fracking. They were all
okay,
using
interesting.
A kind of
okay, yeah.
hydraulic fracturing.
Exactly. What you do in coal bed methane is actually you pump in water, similar to what we do in horizontal drilling now. So their techniques are analogous. And so, yeah, thanks for clarifying that. So fluid injection was common, but the modern hydraulic fracturing is hydraulic drilling and then injection of water. And obviously with coal, what happens is you drill water, but then you extract it. So there's a lot of similarities, absolutely. The point I was trying to make is when coal bed methane was happening, it was not as much of national attention or as with the hydraulic fracturing.
There's people listening and citizens who are very concerned about the hazards of hydraulic fracturing, and if one of the hazards of hydraulic fracturing, whether it was used for oil and gas development or coal bed methane development, is these leaks.
Absolutely.
That's something that citizens need to know.
Absolutely, and I think you raise a good point. I think people should have been concerned about coal, you know, extracting fluids or hydraulic extraction from coal as well. The point we're trying to make is you have to look at the whole framework, and I would even include cattle and livestock. Methane, when it comes to, we take a holistic approach about what all is, including hydraulic fracturing, including a coal bed methane, including animal husbandry, cattle, including wetlands. So the budget is very complex. That's why I try to come back to it. The methane budget is very complex. It's a mixture of these, and pretty much an even mixture of all these sources. And we need to take a very balanced approach in regulating all of them.
So this leak is still leaking, or set of leaks, or whatever the source of it. I mean, is there any movement to plug it up?
Oh, well, we don't know where exactly what the point or the seam sources are. And as said, there's a campaign going on now. What we've created is a very a strong awareness, both in the science community and in the policy community. And obviously in the public about this problem. So I presume what we will hear in the next coming months is a more detailed understanding of the distribution of the sources on a meter to kilometer scale. We would talk about of tens of kilometer scales. So we're going down auto magnitude. We will know what different natural seepage, as well as coal bed methane, oil processing, gas processing. And then we will get to it. But right now, we're at the stage where we're finding out where it is coming. And I'm sure that some of the sources, and I think we should go after the big sources, much like in air quality, we went after the big polluters. So the strategy will be to go after the big polluters or leaks and then work our way down. But I think I hope, and I think this will happen in the coming years.
Now, this is, as you say, a large source as a percentage of methane going into the atmosphere. Is there legal responsibility for this type of carbon pollution? Do you know?
Well, I think I don't think so. Air quality and the Clean Air Act, a lot of the criteria pollutants are regulated. So things like ozone precursors like NOx are regulated. CO is regulated. I know CO2 is not regulated, but as I said, as we work towards a climate treaty and a big sense of state to city level awareness of reducing their carbon footprint, methane is very much. And as I said, the advantage of methane is it's a commodity. By capturing, you're saving the company dollars. You're protecting the public from ozone smog, and on a larger scale, you're slowing down the pace of climate change.
So, let's talk about what methane does when it goes into the atmosphere. It's a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. What does that mean?
Okay, that means on a per molecule basis or a gram to gram basis, methane absorbs is a 25 times more potent a greenhouse gas, which means greenhouse gases operate by absorbing the thermal energy that the Earth radiates out to space. So a molecule of methane, because it absorbs in a window of the spectra, thermal spectra I talked about earlier, the window is actually not saturated, which means that that you put a molecule, it'll absorb it. Whereas things like CO2, many of the windows could be saturated. There's plenty of it. So methane being at low concentration, having unique spectral features that absorb in these bands, make it much, much more absorptive than CO2. Despite the fact that methane is shorter lived than CO2, so methane only survives for 12 years. CO2 lasts for centuries.
But these are some important 12 years that we're talking
about. Critical 12 years. They're very critical 12 years. And not only does, is it a greenhouse gas more potent than CO2, it also makes ozone, like a smog, it's a precursor to that on long range. And if it's from fossil energy activity, it often comes with ethane. And that's a pretty big air quality, it makes ozone. And the third thing is it actually supplies water to the stratosphere. So it actually is a primary source because the upper atmosphere is so cold, all the real water freezes out in the tropopause, which is the 20 kilometers, see the clouds, they're all frozen. But methane actually gets through that, it doesn't freeze. So it's a big supply of water into the stratosphere. So it couples to stratospheric ozone. So methane is a complex beast that does pretty complicated things to our whole climate system, including from the climate to air quality to stratospheric ozone. And it's a very, it's a challenge for researchers like me to actually understand that. CO2 is a simpler thing to challenge. At the end of the day, though, CO2 is the big gorilla in the long term. Methane is a bridge. We really need to deal with it. But in the long term for climate, CO2 is the... It shouldn't distract us from the CO2 problem.
Right. I mean, it's just... It's part of the big problem. And, I mean, what is being done and what kind of research are you doing? How does that research lead to possible solutions? Because, of course, we're all here... less interested in the details than we are in trying to make sure that our planet doesn't get burned up and desertified.
Yeah. So, no, I think that's a very good question. That means the best action is to, understand and nip the problem at the source. So I think all climate research tells you, it identifies what the pace of change is, what the sources are. But eventually the solution is to actually, basically have technology, as we use an energy more and more, to have similar technologies in extraction where we can manage our leaks. Also, as it pertains to CO2, we have technology that is expensive, but you can capture CO2 from power plants and put it back underground. So I think society is thinking about these actions. I think the problem is of scale and economy and public policy. And I think in the coming century, the next generation and our children, grandchildren, we will see a very different world. The awareness of climate change and these fugitive leaks is real. We're talking about it. It's not hidden. We learned about it. It's complicated. So unfortunately, this will take time, national commitment, and we at Los Alamos are part of the, we provide information and data that can help this. But it's something that will take money, time, and it'll create jobs in the process. It's something we value. Let me just add one more thing that we're doing. So this instrument I mentioned, actually, that was at Four Corners, that made this serendipitous discovery of the methane hotspot, which we actually were very, I wouldn't say we're happy, but we're proud of having found something that's triggered a lot of research. This instrument is now in the tropics. It's actually in Brazil. It's actually measuring the rainforest. And it's measuring how much CO2 the rainforest soaks up. And a point I'd like to make is nature actually can help you to a point. And a lot of the CO2 that we emit, carbon dioxide, is soaked up by the rainforest. But the question really becomes is, will this healthy buffering capacity of nature, will it survive? Will it break down? And there's with trees drying, with tropical droughts, there's a lot of concern. So the lab, we actually take a very global, broad perspective. We don't confine ourselves. So we develop technologies, apply them, ranging from methane hotspot and Four Corners down to doing stuff in Brazil. And there's a big component. So climate change is a big program at Los Alamos. A lot of good scientists work across the field, and we're now set to, actually some instruments are going to Antarctica. So we do a lot of operation science. And coming back to solutions, I think the solutions, this is an input to the, the urgency of this problem is real. And I think the administration and the government gets it. And I think I'm hoping that the Paris Convention, there'll be a real, for the first time, commitment from China to the U.S. And China is the biggest CO2 emitter now. So the one thing to realize is U.S. is no longer driving climate change. It's now, because of global economy, it's China that's driving climate
change.
Well,
it's both.
It's both. It's consumerism. It's a globalized. It's been globalized. So China and U.S. need to work together, and they are, with bilateral agreements. And I think we as scientists provide a technical context. But if you add U.S. and China, they add up to be the biggest emitters by far by any region.
How did you become a climate scientist?
Well, I think I would give credit to my graduate school. I was a physical chemist looking at molecular reactions in a chamber, and I found that very esoteric. I wanted to connect to the planet and globe, do something useful. And I did my PhD in a group that was studying stratospheric ozone when the ozone hole was happening. And that was, that science matters, that, in the ozone hole case. Here's another example. The ozone hole was discovered in the early 80s. We signed a Montreal Protocol. We did the best we could. CFCs are banned. The ozone hole will recover in 50 years.
Right, and that meant not using hairspray.
Absolutely.
Or having different kinds of hairspray bottles. This is a much more complicated.
Absolutely. And actually, the industry there worked well together. So it was hairsprays to refrigerants in your cars, and the industry actually joined hands. So here's the key point. It's industry, private sector, China, India, developing countries. We all have to come together technically and responsibly for our next generation to do this. And I think a similar analogy I'm drawing will need to be. It's a bigger problem.
Manvendra Dubey is a climate scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.